Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and welcome to episode 98, The Biennale Approaches, with our special guest, Christopher Hawthorne. Chris Hawthorne was previously the architecture critic of the Los Angeles Times from 2004 to 2018. Then he became the chief design officer of the city of Los Angeles, where I had the good fortune of working with him on several of the innovative programs he did on rethinking pieces of LA infrastructure in the age of electric, maybe autonomous vehicles. And now, of course, Chris is a senior critic at Yale University's School of Architecture. We're having Chris on because Chris has covered many biennales. This is going to be a special episode devoted to criticism, both how one approaches critiquing the Venice Architecture Biennale, Chicago Biennial, and others. But for this time around, Chris is actually part of the curatorial team working with Carlo Rotti Associates on creating Speaker's Corner, which is going to be the built-in conference venue, I guess Speaker's Corner, inside the Arsenale, where he's also hosting a special series on the future and maybe past of criticism. But welcome to Unfrozen, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's dive in. So please tell us about Speaker's Corner. This was teased in Carlo's opening press conference back in February. There's a couple renderings here, but tell us what it's about.
Yes, I'm excited to say that it has just broken ground. It's funny to say that about an exhibition in a biennale, but we just got some photos from inside the Quarteria galleries in the Arsenale where it will be located. So the construction is underway. The project actually was inspired by something I discovered when I was reviewing a newish biography of Vincent Scully, the architectural historian at Yale with whom I studied. A woman named Krista Sykes, who's at Harvard GSD, published a biography of Scully a couple of years ago, which I reviewed for a New York Review of Architecture. And I was a student of Scully's in the early 90s when I was an undergraduate at Yale. I learned in reading that biography that he was part of a team that produced something for the very first Venice Architecture Biennale in 1980, organized by Paolo Portoghese, called the Critics Exhibition or Critics Corner. And of course, most people who know that Biennale know it for a couple of projects. They know the Strada Novissima, which was the kind of line of storefronts of contemporary architecture by figures including Frank Gehry and Rome Koolhaas and Isozaki and Venturi and Scott Brown and many others. Or they know it for the floating theater, the Teatro del Mondo that Aldo Rossi contributed. So I was surprised and fascinated to learn that just at the end of the Strada Novissima, in that section of the Arsenale galleries, was this installation called the Critics Exhibition or Critics Corner. And it turns out that Portoghese invited Scully, as well as Charles Jenks and Christian Norberg Schultz, another historian and critic, as well as Ken Frampton, although Frampton later bowed out after, I think, butting heads with Bob Stern over some other element of the show. So it turns out that present at the creation, as it were, of the Venice Biennale was a real exploration of criticism and the work of critics. And it's rare, as you know, for critics to be invited to take part in a biennale or a biennial, with the exception of panels and, you know, kind of speechifying, talking, but to actually have an installation in the show itself around criticism was something that I didn't know about. And so a colleague and friend of mine, Florencia Rodriguez, who's a critic from Buenos Aires, and who now directs the architecture program at the University of Illinois Chicago, she and I collaborated on a proposal to kind of bring back some version of this, and we started talking with Carlo. We learned that he was interested in having something called Speaker's Corner, which would be a venue for talks and panels and discussions of all kinds, not just related to criticism. So he said, you know, maybe we can fold these things together, and if you can bring an architect onto your team, maybe we'll have you take on the entire thing. So we asked Markley and Sharon Johnston of the LA firm Johnston Markley, who are good friends of mine from my LA days, to join us. And they led the design, their offices led the design of the Speaker's Corner venue itself, which I'll talk about in a second. And then Florencia and I are organizing at Speaker's Corner a series called Restaging Criticism, which will be looking at the future of architecture criticism, inspired, as I said, in part by that 1980 Critics Exhibition. The Speaker's Corner design itself, it takes the form of a small grandstand. Let's see, a kind of petite arena in the Corderia section of the Arsenale Gallery. So in a nice bit of serendipity or historical resonance, very near the place where the Critics Exhibition was located. It will consist of about 50 or so seats. And it will also have a small room beneath the grandstand where we will have a kind of small library and archive and the potential to do smaller or more intimate conversations or conversations with remote guests across the entire run of the Biennale. So we will be there in May for a series of conversations during the opening days. I will be back in July to host some conversations as part of Restaging Criticism that have been organized in collaboration with my students at Yale. I teach a seminar every spring on writing and criticism, and so we have focused in part on thinking about programming for the July Biennale events at Speaker's Corner related to criticism, and then we'll be back for a final set of panels in October, in the fall.
Very nice. Well, I should note for our listeners here, and we'll leave in the show notes, that Carlo's team has come storming out of the gates with a whole series of public programs at the Speaker's Corner and beyond. We'll leave a link in the show notes there. In addition to Chris's stuff at the beginning, on Saturday, May 10th, is Collective Bow Culture, including a number of speakers, including Antonio Gomez Palacio from Dialogue, who I know. And yeah, I think it just goes from there. But Chris, your sessions are not on that program. So tell us, what do you have in store for 8th and 9th during the preview? Because, of course, that is the private preview for practitioners, unless you have something on the opening weekend as well.
We do. We have events across the full 4-day Vernissage plus public opening. Beginning on May 8th and then on May 9th, 10th, and 11th. And if you give me 1 second, I'll just pull up some of those details. So we'll be introducing the program, introducing Speaker's Corner and Restaging Criticism with Sharon, Mark, Florencia, Carlo. We hope a well-known practitioner who is yet to be confirmed, for whom writing and criticism has been an important part of practice. On the 9th of May, we're going to have a conversation on the exhibition as critical vessel or critical platform, looking at biennials and Biennale in particular. And we'll be, of course, lucky to have Florencia as one of the moderators of that discussion, given that she is the director of the Chicago Architecture Biennial opening in September. That group will also include Leslie Loco, who organized the last Biennale in 2023, which I wrote about for the New York Times, as you mentioned, as well as Eric Chen, who has been a prominent figure in architecture culture, including as a curator at M+ and elsewhere, and was recently one of the curators of the recent M+ retrospective on Ian Pei, a critic named Pancho Diaz, and then Sarah Herta, who is from the Grand Foundation in Chicago. We're hoping also to have Michael Meredith. This may be our largest panel, Michael Meredith as well, from Princeton and Moss Architects, who has recently mounted a show on the relationship between writing and building, looking in particular at Stan Allen's work. And I don't know if you have seen do you know about the podcast that he's done in connection with that show, either of you?
No, I was saying we're so deep in the weeds here on the curatorial supergroup and podcast within podcasts. No, what have we missed?
Yes, so I highly recommend it. I'm trying to figure out how to write about it. So Michael, in connection with this show at the Princeton School of Architecture on the work of Stan Allen, who is retiring from the faculty at Princeton, Michael did a kind of accompanying podcast. If you know Michael Meredith, you know that he likes to do things rather informally, and this podcast is a great example of that. There is no, it's a series of interviews with Stan himself, several with Stan, and then other practitioners, including Mark Lee and others connected to Princeton, particularly the Princeton of the 1990s, Monica Ponce de Leon, who's now the dean at Princeton. And it is, I would say, highly underproduced. It has no, not only does it have no music or introduction, Michael doesn't even give a kind of preamble. He just hits record on what I think is his iPhone and starts talking to his guest.
So you're
guest.
Saying we have one up on Michael Merritt?
Yes, exactly. I did exactly. not think we could get more informal than this podcast, but I'm glad.
He's done it, but I really recommend that podcast. It's a fascinating sort of window onto architecture culture, particularly in the 1990s when Stan was quite influential. He was the dean at Princeton for a time. So that will be, again, as I mentioned, looking at the exhibition as a kind of platform or vessel for criticality. And then the following day, May 10th, we're going to do a conversation on the Los Angeles fires, which I'm just finishing up a big piece on for the New York Times, and also on architecture criticism in an era of climate shock. So Michael Maltzen, the LA architect, will join us, Alejandro Hayek, Florencia again, perhaps one or two others. And then on Sunday, May 11th, the final program for restaging criticism of the opening days is looking very specifically at the practice of architectural criticism. So that will include Florencia again, Kate Wagner, Sammy Medina, who's the editor of the New York Review of Architecture, and my editor there, Sam Jacob, and Shumi Bose, two critics, practitioners, and in Sam's case, architect from London. And that panel may also grow, but that's the lineup as it exists now. So looking from a range of perspectives at a contemporary critical practice, and we'll hope to hit similar themes with different speakers in July and again in October.
All right. Well, as given that we're big fans of Kate, having her had on the podcast and having her recite in Prague a few years back, give her space. Got to give her room to operate, Chris. So don't.
I know. Well, on the one hand, we have maybe too many panelists, but we do have 90 minutes, so we should have a good amount of time.
All right. Well, for listeners who did not get their credential requests in on time to make it for the 8th and 9th, so what is the future of criticism, Chris? Give us a preview of the content. Where do you think this is going to go? This is, I should note for listeners that, intelligence, natural, artificial, collective, which I have to say in the cadence of NewPrint ads every time it's in my head.
Wow, very nicely done. I don't think I could have done it so smoothly.
Thank you. It's also, this is like the largest Biennale ever assembled. Carl is quite proud of the fact that they've got like 750 contributors. I'm dying to see how they squeeze it all in, or whether it's like agate type, like post office boxes in the Caymans, all the names in there. But given that size of it, what is the future of criticism? How are you going to fold all this in there, and where do you want to take this at this particular crossroads of architecture?
Right, it is a really huge Biennale. Actually, just as an aside before I get to your question, one of the things I've been doing with my students is having them present on earlier Venice Biennale exhibitions to kind of retrace some of the history of this peculiar show, which, as I mentioned, has a relatively short history compared to the Art Biennale, which is more than a century old. Architecture started only in 1980. And one of my favorite architecture biennales was the one curated by Kazuo Sejima from Sana, and her strategy was typically a director, after being chosen to curate the Biennale, is given a certain budget and then is expected to raise a significant amount of additional funds. And Sejima's attitude was actually, well, let's try to make this work with the money that we already have in hand. And as a result, she did the opposite in some ways of what Carlo is doing. There were basically five major rooms. There were a few others, but basically she gave space to a very small number of rooms that therefore had a huge amount of space and kind of atmosphere. It was very beautifully executed and choreographed, but at the expense of having a big variety of perspectives. And I think Carlo is leaning into the latter approach. So in terms of the future of criticism, one of the things I like about the design that that Sharon and Mark in their office have produced for the Speaker's Corner grandstand is that it, from certain angles, sort of looks like a boat, and you can either see it as a sort of sinking ship, or you can see it as a kind of lifeboat where the survivors or those who might reconstitute a future criticism will be gathering during the course of the Biennale. So I enjoy thinking about it as a kind of space, a kind of architectural space from that point of view. The goal is to really think about new platforms, new ways of reaching audiences. I think the future of criticism is really thinking about how to create, in a very simple sense, some sustainable business models that will take advantage of all of the new ways that we have to reach audiences. So on the one hand, it has never been easier to break into criticism or find an audience. If you're a good writer like Kate Wagner is and you're young, you can find an audience. I mean, Kate is also not only a very talented critic, but also very skilled at thinking about digital media, social media, et cetera. But I think the fact remains that if you're an ambitious young critic now, you can find an audience much more directly and at a younger age than was the case when I was in my 20s, when I was, you know, just, we were all, you know, banging our heads on the doors of the same very small number of institutions. So on the one hand, it's easier than ever to reach an audience and build an audience as an emerging critic. On the other hand, it's never been more difficult, or almost never been more difficult, to think about supporting yourself in a career in criticism. So it's basically like things have been turned inside out. So when I was coming up, there were relatively few platforms, places that covered criticism. There were lots of gatekeepers. It was difficult to break in. But there were a significant number of full-time architecture critic positions in this country and in other countries. And I had one of those at the LA Times. And there was almost a kind of unofficial tenure. Most of my colleagues who are critics covering other fields are still employed at the LA Times, despite the many travails that newspaper has gone through. I would say with the exception of Justin Chang, who is just a great film critic, a friend and colleague who was hired away by the New Yorker magazine. So if you were able to get one of the relatively few, although many more than exist now, critic positions, there was a kind of professional stability that came along with that. There is no such professional stability even for the very successful younger critics. And even those who are attached to publications, Kate is the critic at The Nation, and others who have even the title of critic at a well-known publication, it doesn't come often with a full-time staff position the way it did for me and so many others. I think if you take a longer view of the history of criticism, you realize that the anomalous period perhaps was the one that I've just been describing from my early days. You know, there was something like a dozen, maybe 12 to 15 full-time architecture critics in the United States at a certain point in the 90s, early 2000s. And it's probably that is the anomalous figure. I think criticism, if you take a longer view, has always been a precarious field. It has always been a field that is facing some sense of crisis, often existential crisis. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that, which we could get into, but the most important, I think, for the purposes of this discussion are that criticism is always peripheral. It's always at a remove from, if not estranged from, both the fields that it covers and the publications that support it. So if you're a critic in a newsroom, like the LA Times, you're a strange figure that the editors and the reporters don't really know what to make of. So you're kind of peripheral in your own place of employment. You have a kind of special status, but it's also a peripheral status to a certain degree. And then critics are also peripheral and even estranged from the fields that they cover. And there's some good reasons for that. I think there are good reasons to cultivate some of that distance, actually, as a critic. But the practitioners in any field, any art form, don't quite know what to make of critics either. And I think this is one of the things I talk with my students about. I think that distance or estrangement can be a real virtue, can be a real strength. But it doesn't do a lot to give one a sense of professional security, either in the field that you're writing about or in the field of writing itself or journalism. So in that sense, not so much has changed. And, you know, the other thing that has become a kind of truism is the history of architecture criticism is a history of crisis and a history, as I said, perhaps of existential crisis. So the future of criticism in very reductive terms, looks like more of the same, except in digital form rather than in print or in some other of the traditional forms that it's taken up.
I think a really important piece on this subject came from Alexandra Lang's writing about architecture, which I absorbed quite some time ago now. I think it's more than a decade old now. And I'm wondering if now is the time to bring forward probably not a book, maybe a digital guide, maybe a TikTok video, I'm not sure, to instruct people on how to navigate through this period where that seems rife with opportunity on the one hand, wherein everyone is, if not everyone's a critic, it's everyone's an influencer. But then, you know, how do you not only make a career out of that in the sense of monetizing it, but also to be taken seriously within the community? It seems like there's a new instruction manual that's waiting to be written or spun into existence.
And it's I agree, and I think that that's one thing that may come out of this series in Venice, and Florenzi and I will also be doing a version of these conversations in Chicago as part of the Chicago Architecture Biennial. So we hope that some kind of collection of these conversations might be condensed or boiled down into a book of the kind that you're thinking of, a kind of primer or instruction manual for navigating this this new field or this new version of the field, which does have to do with thinking about business models in particular. And I think that, you know, Alexandra and I overlapped at Yale. I'm a great admirer of her criticism and her writing, and also the way that she has both in that book that you're referring to, which I use in my courses, and in other work of hers, I think helped show the way to a certain extent. Now, to the part of your question about gaining kind of authority or influence, expertise, readership. This is a question I've actually just been talking with my students about in the last couple of weeks. So I teach undergraduates in the fall, and in the spring I teach graduate students at the School of Architecture who are not, thank goodness for them, aspiring critics. They are aspiring practitioners, and they're in a course in a School of Architecture about writing and criticism. So I have necessarily frame the course to really help them think about the relationship, particularly between writing and practice, whether that means being the subject of criticism or thinking about the relationship of writing that architects produce to their practice. And I always have a small handful who are very interested in practicing criticism in a sort of complementary or supplementary way to their architectural practice, but the vast majority of them are aspiring practitioners in architecture, not critics, and they're admitted to the Yale School of Architecture, as most of them are master's students, on the basis of their design work, not on the basis of their writing, which is as it should be. But we were talking about licensure and who gets to call themselves an architect, first of all, and I was telling them some anecdotes about how often I would get notes from licensing boards, the AIA, or in the case of landscape architecture, the American Society of Landscape Architects, when I called someone in print a landscape architect or an architect who does not have licensure. And sometimes they would be quite aggressive about it and say, you know, we're requesting a correction. And my response was always the same. My response was, you know, to quote an old expression, my name's Paul, that's between y'all, which is to say, you can tell someone who's not licensed that they don't have a right to call themselves an architect, and they can decide you know, based on fear of your, you know, sort of licensing authority, whether or not they want to continue to do that. I'm not bound as a critic or a journalist to that agreement. I'm not bound to what the ASLA or the AAA or any licensure body, right, decides. And in fact, hewing quite closely to that definition of who gets to be called an architect in print would mean that I couldn't call Frank Lloyd Wright an architect or Thomas Jefferson or, you know, any number of other people who practiced architecture without being licensed. So then we started talking about, well, how do you decide? And then we were talking about kind of a dedication to craft. And I think architects themselves, I said, if I gave you a list of people and you looked at their work, I think you, even as architecture students, would be able to decide pretty quickly, this half of the list deserves to be called an architect, this half does not. And as a practicing architect, it's not a very difficult distinction, and the same with criticism. So I would say you don't get to be called a critic just because you get a job where that's your in your title. But nor is it as easy to say that anyone can call themselves, you know, as simple to say that anyone can call themselves a critic. It really comes down in both cases, in terms of architecture or criticism, to kind of dedication to craft. And I think any group of critics could look at a list and say, you know, even before Kate Wagner was named the critic at The Nation, we would say she's earned the right to be a critic because she has taken the craft of learning how to write criticism seriously enough. So yes, that's a fuzzy answer in a gray area, but I think that is the kind of distinction that's meaningful. And you know, it was quite common that I would get those kinds of emails from sometimes from architects' own publicists saying, please don't label them architect, call them architectural designer, please, otherwise they're going to get in trouble.
Well, I would say fortunately or unfortunately, no one's writing on behalf of architecture critics to demand that kind of field.
No, that's for sure. Yeah.
Well, I want to
imagine if there was a guild.
Yes, exactly. Well, there is a newspaper guild. We should get the guilds on
there. There actually, there is an International Association of Architectural Critics. I am a member. I'm not sure how I became one, actually. They will be meeting in Venice. So I have never attended a meeting of this group, but I may do that for the first time next month.
I'd like to think of it as a secret society, all of you sitting there with masked identities. Well, yes. I want to get to covering the Biennale itself or biennials in general. So, you know,
yes,
you've covered many of them. My first one was in 2014. I guess it's a couple questions. One, I'm curious your thoughts about the ongoing evolution of the Venice Architecture Biennale going back to 1980. Lots of criticism about whether the Biennale should even exist. Carlo's team has responded with elaborate sustainability guides. There's a lot of discussion about whether this is completely unethical for us to all gather in this, you know, ecologically challenged city. But then also, you know, how does one actually do it? Like, how do you ensure you're complete, that you understand the theme? Because I can only imagine the scale is, of course, antithetical to deadline journalism in terms of just seeing it all. So how do you approach it, or have been approaching it?
It's really daunting the first couple of times you do it. So any biennial, the Biennale itself in Venice, any assignment of that kind, is among the most daunting kinds of assignments you get as a critic, to really, if you want to do it justice, if you really want to make sense of what the curators are trying to do and the extent to which they've reached those goals. Even more daunting, I will say, just to throw this into the mix, is I went once for the New York Times to Milan to cover the Salon de Mobile, the International Furniture Fair. Which is, imagine the Venice Biennale times 10, I think, in terms of square footage. So you're thrown into this giant series of convention halls and you have to race through in a couple of days and make sense of it. And on top of that, there's always the pressure when you go to a place like Venice to be the first or among the first. You know, I talk a lot with my students about moving away from the kind of pressures of daily journalism and the priorities of daily journalism and practicing, as many of them are interested in, a kind of slow journalism. We talk a lot about the model of Ada Louise Huxtable, who in the latter stages of her career, when she moved over to the Wall Street Journal after many years, of course, at the New York Times, when she was in her 80s, would often, you know, a new building would open, there would be a new development at in the rebuilding process at Ground Zero. All of us critics at the other daily newspapers would trip over ourselves to be the first to get a piece in print. And there would be this sort of, you know, series of pieces that were published one right after the other, kind of immediate succession. And then a few weeks would go by, and then Ada Louise's piece would drop, and it would inevitably be the definitive piece, because she had so much more experience than all of us, and she also was in no rush, and she took the time that she needed, and she was quite a diligent and dedicated reporter as well. So she took the time that she needed to really understand a subject from all angles, and then she would weigh in, and we would all be made to feel a little bit foolish about how quickly we had rushed to try to be first instead of to try to be, you know, best or most thoughtful. So in the case of the Venice Biennale, you know, when I covered it for the New York Times 2 years ago, Leslie Loco's Biennale, I had, you know, these kinds of platitudes ringing in my ears. I had been talking with my students about the benefits of taking one's time, et cetera. And then as soon as I landed in Venice and talked to my editor at the New York Times, her first question was, how soon can you file? You know, not what do you make of it? You know, how long do you, what would make the most sense in terms of a piece? You know, how soon can you file? Because that's how newspaper editors think. That's how they're trained. It's not surprising. So it's, you know, once the advantage of the Biennale is it has a very clear structure. I would say, to get back, Greg, to your question, there's not just an ecological critique. There's also a critique of the makeup of the Venice Biennale and other biennials, but Venice in particular as very much a colonial construct of this little microcosm of the world as seen from a corner of Europe, national pavilions that have mostly just been the national pavilions of Western and colonial powers, and that group has grown over time. But the very construct of it is very vulnerable, I think, to a critique, as it is from an ecological perspective, the fact that we all fly in there to say things about sustainability and, you know, and then fly back. So those are two very valid critiques. But the structure of it does lend itself to getting a handle on it over time, which is to say the arrangement typically is a main show organized by a curator who has been selected just for that show. So Carlo Rodi in this case, Leslie Loco, Sejima, as I mentioned, Ron Coolhaus, going back to Paolo Portoghese in 1980, Aldo Rossi famously on more than one occasion. And then there are the national pavilions that are organized separately, sometimes in very close conversation with the larger theme and sometimes very much doing their own thing. But once you have a sense of that basic structure, you know, you spend the bulk of your time, let's say maybe 2/3 of your time as a critic, if you're turning around a review, a daily review fairly quickly, you get a sense of the larger show, its themes, how it's executed. If you've been to many, as I have, you can compare it pretty quickly in your own mind to the approaches that other curators have brought. Leslie's, for example, really stood out as being quite different. Focusing on Africa, focusing on histories of colonialism, and connecting that quite brilliantly, I think, with conversations about extraction and energy as well. And that was really the masterstroke of that Biennale in terms of its curatorial approach. And then you try to make sense of the national pavilions, and many of which struggle to learn the lesson that it's not quite a one-liner that works best, but a very direct message that is relatively easily grasped by a visitor who is seeing 25 of those national pavilions in the course of a single afternoon or day or maybe 2 days, if they're really committed, is best, rather than endless, you know, the kind of worst kind of national pavilion is endless infographics and text, wall text, no matter how virtuous or intelligent the message it's all adding up to. You know, there's only so much of that that your brain can contain as you wander from one of the national pavilions to the next. So, you know, it definitely gets easier over time, and I go in now. I mean, it's different now because I'm in the show, right? I won't be writing about it, which will be a nice relief, actually. But when I go in and I am writing about it, I have a very specific idea of what my strategy is, what points I'm going to hit, how much time I'll spend in each section, and then how much time I need for writing.
Talking about this with the hinge point as the 1980 initial Biennale being a part of the discussion here, made me think of two things. One is the timing of that event was such that it was pretty much coincidence with peak postmodernism, maybe even a little bit late postmodernism, which if you want to talk about the intersection of practice and critique, postmodernism would seem to be the most literal, figurative form that has ever taken, because you had architects who were criticizing the received homilies of modernism and throwing them, in the river along with a bunch of pediments and columns, and doing it in Venice puts an extra touch on it. So I want to hear a little bit about your thoughts on that, on what that meant for postmodernism to have that be the first Biennale of architecture. And then second, because now I feel much more justified in doing slow journalism, slow criticism. I know The Brutalist came out like 6 months ago, but people are still talking about it. And the denouement of that movie was in fact the 1980 Biennale. And
that's right.
I was curious how that landed with you and how the movie landed with you generally.
Yes. Okay. Two of my favorite subjects, actually. 1980 Venice Architecture Biennale and the ways that the Brutalist uses and abuses architectural history. So let's start with 1980. Yes. The title was The Presence of the Past. I don't know if I'd say that we'd hit peak postmodernism by 1980. I would put that later in the 80s. But certainly, this was a kind of coming out party for a particular version of postmodernism that moved in the direction, I think, unfortunately, although I think there are a lot of great things about that Biennale, unfortunately, in the direction of a more scenographic or two-dimensional kind of postmodernism that played more into the kind of stage set qualities, as opposed to a more layered mining, remixing of history in architecture, as opposed to, as a reaction to late modernism and its alliance with capital. I think it's really important to understand some of the basis here of where the more politically pointed postmodernism and postmodern analysis was coming from, which is that by the 1960s, corporate late modernism, so think of what SOM or other big firms were producing, was very much in alliance, in league with Wall Street, with capitalism, with the war machine, with the same kind of elites that were prosecuting the war in Vietnam. And so the reaction was not just to the kind of banishment of history by modernism, by orthodox modernism or international style modernism. It was also a reaction to the kind of corner that late modernism had painted itself into by the 1960s. So by the time Complexity and Contradiction comes out by Robert Venturi as a kind of opening salvo in what became postmodernism, that's 1966. Actually, first published in Perspecta, the Yale Architecture Journal, in 1965 in an issue that was edited by a very young Bob Stern and also included one of my very favorite essays to teach, which I highly recommend, Charles Moore's essay, You Have to Pay for the Public Life, which holds up remarkably well. So there began to be these rumblings of a reaction against where modernism had taken itself by the middle 60s and Complexity and Contradiction, and then Learning from Las Vegas in the early 70s, a lot of other work. That leads to a couple of different avenues for postmodernism, and the avenue that Portoghese chose in The Presence of the Past, to some degree, particularly in Strada Novissima, which I mentioned was the best-known feature of the 1980 Biennale. It's the storefront almost literally two-dimensional renditions by many of the figures who became star architects or celebrity architects in the decade, two decades that follow between, let's say, 1980 and 2000. In the case of the critics exhibition, the best documented is Charles Jenks's, and I recommend listeners go find images of it on the Jenks Foundation website, which is quite a remarkable archive. So he titled his section, it had a kind of a classic Jenksian catchphrase, which was "all the wasms have become isms." And physically, it consisted of a book, oversized sort of representation of a book that was sunk into the gallery floor, and then a kind of oversized pencil as well that came to a peak. And that peak, actually, of the pencil, sharpened pencil tip, is, you can see if you kind of squint a little bit and look at our installation, Speaker's Corner, in elevation or in profile, you can see that sort of a little hidden reference to that pencil. So it was one of the forces that Biennale that helped tip postmodern architecture into a more scenographic direction that then became sort of codified by figures like Michael Graves, and then certain buildings by Venturi and Scott Brown and other architects. And was less about a critique or a reintegration of history in a full sense than it was buildings whose facades began to quote in more simplistic fashion from architectural history. Now, to your question about the Brutalists, it's funny because I wrote a kind of late piece on the Brutalists for Yale Review, which is edited by one of my old Slate editors, Megan O'Rourke, who's one of the most gifted editors I've ever worked with. So I was very happy to have a chance to work with her again. And I wrote a piece kind of exploring why all the architecture critics I know hated the Brutalist and all the film critics I know loved it, and what it was about that split. And I my sense was the appropriate reaction to that film was a kind of ambivalence, appreciation for certain of its ambitions, certain of its ability to really produce a kind of epic scope on a budget of $10 million, which is remarkable, partially by filming in Budapest, maybe by skimping and using some AI too, which people have taken issue with. But I think the architecture critics have hated it because its understanding of architecture and Brutalism in particular is about a half an inch deep. It seems that Brady Corbet maybe read a couple, one or two books on Brutalism. But he used Brutalism and architecture, I think, quite effectively in service of the film's larger themes, which are a critique of capitalism, of American Brutalism, of the fact that, the protagonist, I think, to begin with, some of my friends in the world of architecture criticism who wrote about the movie misunderstood the title to begin with. The title, I think, very clearly refers not to the architect, but to the client who... and then the protagonist of the film, the architect, is brutalized twice over, first by the Holocaust and then by American capitalism as an artist. Now, it falls into certain traps and relies on certain tropes that many of us in architecture criticism have been trying to bury for good, starting with the kind of Ayn Randian notion of the lone genius fighting the good fight against compromise and Philistinism. Nonetheless, I thought the movie on balance did have something important to say about this moment in American culture and used architecture to do that. Now, it didn't always use architecture in an especially sophisticated way, as I mentioned. And to get back to the Biennale, the epilogue of the film takes place at the first architecture Biennale, as you mentioned. And I think, again, to maybe touch on... I wouldn't call it dilettantism, but the film's understanding of architecture and particularly Brutalism. I think Brady Corbet, the filmmaker, was looking for a setting in the architecture world for the epilogue. He read enough about the 1980 Biennale to learn that the title was The Presence of the Past, and didn't understand that in the context of postmodernism and the evolution of postmodernism, which we've just been talking about, but instead saw a connection to the trajectory of the film, where the kind of community center that is being designed and built by this architect throughout the film smuggles references to concentration camp into it, as anyone who's seen the film knows. And that is a kind of presence of the past. Also, it's not the kind of presence of the past, obviously, that Paolo Portoghese was meaning. And so when I saw it and I saw that connection, it rang incredibly false and hollow, and it didn't reflect a kind of understanding of what that Biennale was actually trying to do on its own terms, but it was of a piece with the film's larger reading / misreading of architectural history, I would say. But I liked it more than most of the people in the architectural world, as you can tell.
But it is essential viewing for anyone headed to Venice for this, because it is the only film in which the climax is the Venice Architecture Biennale.
No, I almost dropped my... I was in there taking notes. I saw it twice because I was writing something. I had a little notebook. I almost dropped my notepad in the North Haven multiplex when I saw that the epilogue was at the very first Architecture Biennale, when I was just mounting this project, also inspired by that same show.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, Chris. This has been a fantastic deep dive into this. But for those listeners who have stayed until the end, what is your strategy for approaching the Biennale? What are you looking forward to in this installation, or how would you approach it? Because this year also the International Pavilion in the Giardini is closed for renovation, so it's much more going to be like International in the Arsenale and the National Pavilions in the Giardini. So if you had to speed run it, we have it in one day, like what's your approach and what would you want to see?
It's going to be both easier and harder this year for the reasons that you mentioned. So because of the number of participants that Carlo has brought together and the fact that the Italian pavilion is closed. So normally the main show is split between the galleries and the Arsenale, the old shipbuilding yards, and then just a little bit to the east in the Giardini, the Italian pavilion. And then, as I mentioned, the national pavilions each have their own little building. So this year the main show will be entirely in the Arsenale galleries. Ours in the Corderia section, which is the old rope building, part of the shipbuilding factories. And we're thrilled that we're able to be in that location close to where the critics exhibition was in 1980. So, if you only had a day, you just got to split your time. You got to spend, 3 or 4 hours in the main show. And then see as many of the pavilions as you can. There are always certain standouts, old reliable standbys, and they tend to be the ones actually, let's put it this way, there's an inverse relationship between the amount of bureaucracy required to produce any given national pavilion and the strength of what's produced. So those countries that have a relatively loose system and often hand off the organization of the pavilion to a young group of architects or curators, quite often produce the best results. And historically, that has been the Belgian pavilion, the Polish pavilion, a handful of Asian pavilions. The American pavilion is really up and down. It is encased in lots of bureaucracy. And of course, now we'll have to be even more cautious than normal. But given that, I think this idea of the porch, which is the theme, has some real potential. We'll see what they do with it. I was going to say try to take 2 days and spend, one day in each section. And don't feel bad if your head is spinning. I have a sense after having been a veteran of many of these and having had to write pieces and, file reviews in 36 hours, either for the LA Times or the New York Times, it has gotten easier for me to kind of get a quick sense of what the animating, driving themes are and how well executed the show is compared to others. But if it's your first time or your second time, it can be really dizzying to try to make your way through it in just a few hours. Let me say one thing in closing, which is the one thing I love about Venice, for all of its issues, for all the critiques that are quite valid from an ecological and, let's say, colonial point of view, as I mentioned, it is still pretty much the only place where the whole architectural world kind of does at least attempt to come together. And it does feel that way in a way that the Art Biennale, for example, in Venice does not. It does not. The art half of the Biennale does not have that kind of feeling of a critical mass. The architecture side is the closest the architectural world comes to that, I would say. And so for that reason alone, I always look forward to it.
And so too will we. And thank you, Christopher Hawthorne, for spending time with us this afternoon. This is Unfrozen. We are talking about the upcoming Venice Biennale, at which Mr. Hawthorne will be curating a writer's corner for the, I think it's the first time they've done something like that at the Biennale. So a place for critics, a place for practitioners, and a whole constellation of leading lights will be there. We hope you'll be there too. And if you can't be there, follow it with us. We'll be there.